candidates for mayor take the stage for a televised debate? The answer is no for a local charter school and new projects coming to life downtown. Good morning and live from Studio 5. This is First Coast Connect, and I'm Melissa Ross. Thanks for listening. Just ahead, all of the top stories of the week with our Friday Media Roundtable. You can join us. Give us a call. It's 549-2937. Then later, we'll go live up to Amelia Island for the excitement of the Concours d'Elegance. All of that ahead this morning. But first, it's Friday, and here to discuss a busy news week, we welcome Mark Woods of the Florida Times-Union. Good morning, Mark.
Good morning.
Tim Gibbons is here, editor of the Jacksonville Business Journal.
Good to be here.
Radio host Angela Spears
Happy
back
Friday.
With us. Happy Friday. And Shelton Hull of Folio Weekly.
Good morning.
Guys, so good to have you. And lots to discuss from the week. There's some development news we'll get into in a few minutes. There was a dust-up this week over a proposed charter school that got denied on the north side. That's coming up, too. But our top story this Friday, Mayor Lenny Curry made his case on live TV this week for a second term at City Hall as his top rival, Anna Brochet, went at him hard on his record in office. This is all of the four top-line candidates for mayor took the stage in a televised debate. Now, Curry took incoming from everyone on the stage about his record, public safety, a failed attempt to sell JEA, and more. For his part, the mayor accused Anna Brochet of violating the state's sunshine law during her tenure on the Jacksonville City Council. Now, at the same time, low-polling challenger Jimmy Hill may have helped himself and maybe indirectly helped Anna Brochet. He came across as a refreshing alternative in the reactions of some viewers and voters who watched the debate. Early voting is underway right now, and the question, of course, is, are the dynamics set for Mayor Curry to clear the 50% threshold on March 19th, or can his challenger, Anna Brochet, force him into a runoff? We begin the hour with a closer look. As we discuss the top issues in this mayor's race, it's 549-2937 to join us, 549-2937. Or go online, send your emails to firstcoastconnect@wjct.org, tweets to @MelissaInJax, and we welcome your comments on Facebook as well. Shelton Hull, let's start with you. It was on the stage, the one chance people could evaluate all of the candidates, Mayor Curry, Anna Brochet, Jimmy Hill, and Omega Allen. Who all had moments where they shone in this hour-long broadcast. Still, though, you know, for the mayor, the challenge is to just simply stay the course and win this election outright. Is he going to do that?
Well, I think he did pretty well for himself at the last debate. It was he's really the big winner out of this because Brochet needed a knockout blow, and there was no knockout blow. He took incoming, as you said, but when those hits came in, he was able to deflect pretty well and keep the focus on his record. And as long as he keeps the race about him and about the and not about the other challengers, I think it stays to his advantage.
Tim Gibbons, what are your thoughts?
I mean, it's always the old, you know, are you better off now than you were 4 years ago? And that's kind of gotten banal over the years since Reagan coined it. But the Curry can point to what he's done, and I think that you have a lot of voters who might not be overwhelmingly enthusiastic about voting for Curry, but they see no reason to change horses midstream. Now, it does have to be pointed out when we talk about that getting better. We did have 4 years of an administration with a much different economy. And I always find interesting in looking at politics where we say, well, you know, we expanded stuff and balanced the budget. Well, sure, but you also had more tax revenue coming in. So I don't know. It's always interesting, I think, as we sit around this table, we pay a lot of attention to this stuff, and it's hard to put ourselves in the shoes of people who really
don't. They're only just now tuning in,
right.
So,
I don't know. If you watch that debate and you haven't been following the entire thing, how does that hit you? I'm not really sure.
Yeah, for people watching and dialing into this for the first time, Mark Woods, that was really their first chance to sort of measure the candidates side by side. Anna Brochet came out swinging against the mayor, hitting him on public safety, claiming she was the one who stopped the controversial sale of JEA. The mayor accused Brochet of violating the Sunshine Law. And then the undercard candidate, Jimmy Hill, came across to some voters, at least ones we've heard from here at WJCT, as the most down-to-earth, refreshing candidate on the stage. And so If this goes to a runoff, could it be in part because Hill draws some votes away from candidates, or voters who might be inclined to vote for the mayor? Could that dampen the mayor's vote total enough to get the two top vote getters into a runoff?
Right. I mean, I guess first of all is how many people actually watch the debates. I don't even really know. I mean, I really appreciate everyone who put it on, the media involved, JU for hosting it. I thought Kent Justice did a good job.
Yeah.
But I don't really know how many people, you know, these days there's so much TV, so much stuff. Did people really tune in to get their first impression of? I think those that did, you're right. I think Jimmy Hill probably was the one that moved the needle. And but if he moved the needle, that's good news for Anna Broche. You know, somebody had said having Omega Allen and Jimmy Hill on stage was damaging to Anna Broche, that she wouldn't be able to be up there side by side with him. But I think it's the opposite at this stage, that if either of those two got votes in the debate, that's good for Anna Broche. And I don't know, you know, I don't know, who knows what the voter turnout, the who will Democrats vote for, how many will turn out. So there's all these factors. It's really, really hard to say. I don't know.
549-2937. And of course, the Democratic Party failed to field a candidate for mayor, Angela Spears. And so for a moderate Republican like Anna Broche, her only hope of getting into a runoff is to get the majority of Democratic votes.
And she's been out there trying to, from what I've been hearing and what I've been seeing, is to definitely reach out across the party line to Democrats. But going back to what Mark said, many people who I've spoken with, they're not talking about Anna Broche after this debate. Many people are talking about Jimmy Hill. And it's just, it's so surprising to hear that. I did an interview with most of the candidates myself, and I remember asking Jimmy Hill, you know what, the polls are showing that you're nowhere near being in the top two, anywhere near it. He kept saying, well, just wait till people hear what I have to say. So it's very interesting. And he's reaching out, I know, across the aisle as well, going to every event. He says he goes to every event, talks with people who may not be on his side or agree with him, the same as Anna is doing, is reaching out across the aisle.
It's interesting that this is a guy whose candidacy was born out of anger at the way his boat show was treated, yes, by the city apparatchiks, I guess.
Which I
and
think
he's
is,
been upset about it enough to run for office twice.
And I think that's one of the reasons he came across well on the stage was, it doesn't honestly make sense. I think the most sense is, why the heck would you want to be mayor? I mean, like, Tim Gibbons has like a horrible job. But this guy's
Tim Gibbons for mayor. There we go. Tim Gibbons for mayor.
This guy's up there, and it's like, it's really clear why. I'm not exactly sure why he wants to be mayor, but it's really clear why he wants to beat Lenny Curry. And I think voters
is a grudge candidacy a legitimate candidacy?
Yeah. I think that's important to point out that it in all of the talk after the debate, there has been this kind of thing of Jimmy Hill came across, you know, the best on the stage and has the most to gain from it. But again, it goes back to, we're media people who are looking for a story out of the debate. And Lenny Curry didn't give us one. Anna Broche didn't give us one. So to a certain extent, if Jimmy Hill doubles, you know, if he gets into high single digits, that's impressive. But I think that context-wise, I don't think that debate is going to end up with him at St. James Place. You know, he's not going to, based on just that debate,
he's not
going to win. And as you
kind of hinted, maybe that's not his goal.
Right. Maybe.
So let's go to your calls. We're talking politics and some other news of the week this Friday on our media roundtable with Tim Gibbons, Angela Spears, Shelton Hall, and Mark Woods, and myself, and all of you out there. So call us up right now at 549-2937. Emails to firstcoastconnect@wjct.org. Tweets to @MelissaInJax. Early voting is underway now. Yes, there's an election coming up. I know, another one, which is another story in and of itself. Yes. Why are we voting in March for all of these offices? Well, that's controversial, too. We'll talk about that, too. But first, let's go to your calls. 549-2937. Tom on the West Side. Hi, Tom. Good morning.
Ah, good morning to you all, too. Yes, I listened to the debate on the radio, and I was impressed by three of the candidates. I've never been impressed by Curry, and he continued that trend. I particularly didn't like his attack on Broche about an investigation that turned out to be unfounded. And I feel his entire approach to governing Jacksonville is just to kick the can down the road, like what he did with the pension reform, what he was trying to do with the JEA, and also apparently what he's going to be doing with the landing. And all in all, I think the better choice for Jacksonville is pretty much anyone but him.
Well, who will you vote for? Well, Tom, who will you vote for then?
I'm probably going to vote for Brochet, though. Like you've been saying, Mr. Hill was pretty impressive. I just don't know very much about him yet at this point.
Okay. Thanks for that. And that speaks to how difficult it is for candidates to even get in front of the voters if they don't have a lot of money to spend. That debate was their one, for two of those folks on stage, that debate was their one opportunity, Shelton.
That's right. Mark raised a good point about turnout. I don't think Curry's base can really be cut into. I think he has a solid core of supporters that are going to come out and vote for him no matter what. The question is how many voters can come out and vote for these other people. And it's going to be probably a low turnout election. We saw from the blue wave last year that a liberal democratic voice and essentially a liberal democratic message can pull a majority in this city. But it's a matter of can Brochet and these other candidates motivate people to come out.
Right. Andrew Gillum was a really charismatic political figure.
Yep.
We don't have that level, I don't think. I think it's fair to say, of the political muscle that he had.
Well, that is the other
in
question.
In Duval County.
After the blue wave, not having a Democratic candidate on the ballot for mayor, a lot of people see as a missed opportunity.
And definitely is a missed opportunity.
And five city council races that have no Democratic candidate in the race.
Yeah, and by the way, when you go to vote for mayor, vote for sheriff, vote for tax collector, vote for your city council representatives. You should have already gotten your sample ballot in the mail, Duval. Look at it.
And
go and vote.
And remember, too, that don't just vote for your city council person, vote for the at-large as well.
Oh, yeah.
Continue on to the ballot that you can vote for your at-large candidates.
And there's some interesting competitive races that, historically haven't been competitive on some of those down ballot. The administrative offices like tax collector and, property appraiser that isn't historically, property appraiser, I don't think it's actually been challenged in years. It's always just been a kind of,
right.
This is the person picked for.
We have real choices on some of these contests. So, exercise your franchise to vote, people. Don't blow this off.
And, I was going to say earlier that after Jimmy Hill's performance, Anna Brochet really should be sending him like a bottle of his favorite whiskey. But but I get the sense that he's already well stocked.
But here's the other interesting thing, I think, out of the debate is obviously we're focused on the mayoral race, but there's also the question of what does a conversation like that inject into the political discourse. And the stuff on the landing I found particularly interesting. Brochet came out very strongly against the mayor's landing deal. And, those people not in this room who are cynical might look at the timing of that deal being reached right before the election and say it is a election-related timing. But the idea of I don't know if the people of Jacksonville actually like that deal or just like the idea that something's being done with the landing.
Well,
and in some ways, after the election, that conversation has to continue.
And the mayor can credibly say to people already inclined to vote for him, look, you may disagree with some aspects of my record, but here's what I have accomplished. I can point to a list of accomplishments, which any incumbent has to do. Mark.
Both him and John Gotti apparently get stuff done.
that was the Jimmy Hill shot at the end of the debate.
They are on a roll today, Melissa.
Yes.
John Gotti would definitely have a plan for the landing.
But are you saying John Gotti for mayor?
Oh. All right, guys. It's 549-2937. Lisa on the west side. Hi, Lisa. You're on the radio. Good morning. Happy Friday.
Good morning. Happy Friday to you. I wanted to make the comment that a group that I don't think we've heard a lot from officially yet is women in general. And when I have talked to women, both Democrat and Republican and working women and non-working women, they feel like this administration has been bullying to Anna Brochet, and their overall treatment of women is just not what we would like to see in a city of this size in this day and age.
Lisa, thanks for that. Anna Brochet has certainly not led with her gender on the campaign trail, Mark, but she's just campaigned as an alternative to what we've had for the past 4 years. However, if she does make it into the runoff, that could be a factor, I think, the support of female voters who would like to see a female mayor and who agree with the caller about those aspects of this race.
Yeah, the caller certainly isn't alone in those sentiments. You hear that quite a bit, and I know there's that on social media. There's people I talk to who basically echo that. Again, I don't, you know, it's hard to say how big a factor that is. I don't know. It'll be interesting after the fact to see, you know, all the breakdown, party lines and gender lines and how this played out. But there is some element of that. I don't know how much.
Seedley is in Beauclair. Hey, Seedley. Good morning. Is that your name? Good morning.
Yes, that's correct. Good morning.
Good morning.
Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
Yes, I have a question or comment. When I get visitors from out of town, I take them around and then downtown for a stroll on the Riverwalk and then stop at the landing for a meal. If the Riverwalk is torn down, what in the world is downtown to attract anyone? I'll take the answer off the air.
Sure, thank you. Okay, so the city now owns the landing, effectually. They're going to almost certainly demolish it unless grassroots activists can stop that. People who are very upset about all of the teardowns in the city's urban core. They're arguing, don't tear down a perfectly good building, adapt it and reuse it into something else. But let's say that property comes down. What will we see in its place? Can they develop something dynamic, vibrant enough to make it a focal point? Or will that just become another parcel downtown? And will the focal point shift over here where we sit at WJCT right now around the football stadium where Shad Khan is planning to do huge development of mixed-use retail, concerts, business, condos, marina, the whole thing? I mean, is that where we're headed?
That's the entire, I mean, that really is the question. In some ways, like the questions of downtown 2019 are exactly what you just said. There's a couple of different strands of that fight. One being the idea of, why are we going to knock it down if we don't know what we're doing with it? People look at the old courthouse site where it's, you know, knock it down and they will come, which is, you know, a really crappy idea for a movie. but the idea that we don't need more just open park space downtown, and if we're going to forge ahead, we have to have a plan for it. And then you get into that other fight of what is downtown and how do you make downtown vibrant? And is the sports complex the way to do that? You get into weird technical conversations about what downtown is, but, you know, where you are right now is not the heart of downtown. And if you're somebody from out of town, are you coming down to the stadium or do you want to go to downtown is kind of an open question.
Yeah, I mean, I think what they plan to build around the stadium is certainly going to be interesting and exciting, but there's no replacement for the urban footprint of a downtown that was laid out a couple of hundred years ago, has a lot of old buildings, has that that mix of foot traffic and business and government workers. And
well, you can
and
just all, take all, the skyway from down. Oh, wait. No.
But those are, you know, when you, for example, if you go to any other city with an interesting urban center, whether it's here in the Southeast like Charleston or Savannah or other cities around the country, you're attracted to the urban core if there's a lot happening and it's the mix of old and new that is exciting for people.
And people want a destination. We want Jacksonville to be that destination. And when you think of Jacksonville, what do you tell your friends of when they come here? I have friends from obviously from out of town. When they say, oh, what can we do in Jacksonville? Where can you go? And I don't think I tell them to come downtown and see anything downtown. Because I'm a shopper, I tell them, oh, go to the South Side. Let's go to the Town Center. You have the beach. And that's really about it. So you're right. We do need something that's going to be vibrant, that's going to be, wow, come to Jacksonville. And it does need, to Tim's point, we need something in the urban core. We need something that's going to be there. And I don't think a green space is necessarily it. People I've been talking with, that's not what they want to see is another green space. We have a park downtown right here by you, Melissa.
Yep. Mm-hmm.
Right by the station.
And it's unclear when, if they do tear down the landing, how they're going to get investors, how they're going to get investment capital, because who's going to invest in a parcel of land that is best known for not being well run for the past 30 years? The landing, in terms of the city's brand, in terms of our skyline, in terms of all the promotional materials, the landing is right there at the center. And if the heart of downtown was a human heart, it would be getting wheeled in for a bypass right now. And maybe that's what Curry plans to do with the landing.
You really think so? You really? See, I don't know that I agree with that. I spend a lot of time downtown.
And I love it.
And there's a lot, there's actually, you know, a lot going on. I like spending time downtown.
And there's more going on. I think that's kind of the part of the subtext of the landing conversation. Is it's not the same conversation as 10 years ago. Mm-hmm. 10 years ago, there was less happening downtown. And you could say the landing was failing just because downtown's failing. But now, the Ambassador Hotel project is tremendously exciting. You have, the Barnett is actually coming online, which 10 years ago was just, a glimmer in Steve Atkins' eye. And now, it's happened.
The Barnett Bank redevelopment on Laura Street.
I mean, you have projects happening downtown. So the thought is, well, let's build upon those, not tear down a structure and just hope.
Let's go to Scott in Orange Park. Hi, Scott. Good morning. What are your thoughts?
Hey, good morning. First of all, if they're going to tear anything down, if you don't have crabs, you have vultures. If you don't have vultures, you have worms. The kind of people that come and gobble things up, the Tony Slamans, the people who you see around town who have traditionally always these same Republicans, the giant 4x4 signs in the front of their lots. They use the city's, they use the public funds as their coffers to develop what they want to develop to maximize their profits. That's their business model. And until that dynamic changes, you're not going to see that anybody being able to challenge people that come along like Curry. It's real difficult. The whole mindset of the voting population has to change. People, I had a friend of mine, a black city councilman I've known for years, say, he was talking about his race, saying, "We're 30% of the power of the city. When are we going to recognize our power? Do we have any?" And the answer, quite frankly, is no, because of years of entrenched disenfranchisement, of an actual dumbing down, like they're doing from a state level with education. They're dumbing down. The thing is, how do we go out and educate people and get them motivated? My comment back to him when he made that comment included, the way the mindset of a lot of common people is, unless they're getting something, they're not going to try and do anything because they don't see any reward. And beyond that, I guess, life greed thing, the way you want a better life, they don't feel like they have any power, like their vote's not even going to matter.
Yeah, I hear you, Scott.
They stay ignorant and informed.
I got you, Scott. Okay.
Hi, Shelton. Hi, Melissa. Have a good morning.
Thank you. Thank you, Scott. And here's a related tweet from Robin. I really don't understand why the most important position in Jacksonville is being voted on in March. This will be a low turnout election because it is in March. A long time ago, the city made a decision to separate these local elections out from national cycles. The idea being that if you crowd up the ballot with too many races, that would be too overwhelming. Of course, some cynics might say depressing turnout, as we will see on March 19th, benefits the favored few. So what about that?
Well, there's a case to be made on both sides in terms of having the election in March. But when we talk about turnout, a low turnout election, the fact that we can, a couple weeks out, already predict this as a low turnout election, that's unacceptable. The people of this city and the people of this country need to understand that voting exists for a reason. And everyone wants to complain and have their issues with what one politician or another is doing. But if it takes Trump versus Hillary to push turnout above 50% nationally, that's on the people.
Actually, that's my pitch to people would be exactly that it will be a low turnout, that your vote matters more when fewer people are coming out. So this is the time to go out and vote passionate about, if you think you like one of these candidates or don't like one of them.
It's interesting. I've run into a few young people, Melissa, and this one young lady and I were talking, and she goes, "Oh, I just don't vote." And I'm like, "Wow, really?" And I told her, "Here's your task. I've challenged her. Let's vote." And some other young people, the last election, I said, "Why didn't you vote?" "Oh, there's an election." I didn't realize that. Or some of them may say, oh, I just forgot. It's not important to me. What are the issues that are important to me? I had one couple tell me, well, we just don't do that. Mm-hmm. You know, so we've got to get people to understand the importance. And especially when it comes to young people, when I see young African-American people, you know, you hate to say, oh, people died for us to have that right. Right. Because that story kind of, but they did.
They did.
You know, because, you know, because you don't want to hear it, but they're still dying. People have died for that right for us to vote.
Larry is downtown. Let's take one more call on this and then we'll kind of move along. Hi, Larry.
Okay.
Good morning.
Hey, how are you?
Okay. Thanks for calling.
I'm a merchant of downtown for 50 years. And I've seen a lot of stuff come and go, but moving the JEA out of the core of downtown is a terrible idea. We are 32,000 people short downtown than we were in the mid-80s. And taking them out of the core is where we need the people. Is it, we're paying people now to come into downtown. And the other thing is moving them out towards the
stadium. Larry, what's your business?
I'm in the food business.
Can you tell us which?
Well, it's Desert Rider Sandwich Shop.
All right. Oh, yay.
We all know that place.
Everybody go have a sandwich at Larry's Desert Rider Shop.
We will see.
See,
you
we
later.
Want to give you a little free publicity, Larry. That's all. Mm-hmm.
But okay, but let me tell you, moving it to the stadium, haven't we learned our lesson with the convention center? You start spreading things out too much, and the core suffers. We need to keep them in the core. That's all I can tell you.
I understand your point of view. And that's Larry, go have a Camel Rider or a Desert Rider. Unique to Jacksonville.
Yep.
It's a Duval thing.
New York Times,
at the
did a
Desert
story on
Rider
a
Sandwich
ago.
Shop. Well, so what? Okay, so let's downtown business owners like him. They have a point of view, too.
I mean, that really is. If the question of downtown development is the city going to put its resources into the Shipyards Lot J around the sports area and build that up, because, you know, Jacksonville does not have the need for a landing and a massive shipyard development, at least not, you know, as the landing has been envisioned to be. So the idea of if we're putting all of our eggs in this basket, that will be to the detriment of the smaller, very center of the city. You know, and the idea that why would you want JEA to move to Lot J? It's to bring all of those people so you can kickstart the businesses here.
Yeah.
If you're a business who's downtown now who is feeding those people at lunch break during the week and they move, you're going to actually see businesses who are affected.
Here's a tweet. I just returned from a quick getaway to Savannah, parked the car at the hotel, hit the riverfront, and spent so much money and did so gladly. Jacksonville doesn't have that kind of downtown atmosphere or places to spend like that. And that's true. Part of the reason for that, of course, is we had a great fire in 1901 that destroyed our historic urban center. Savannah and Charleston have preserved theirs. That's only part of the reason, but just making a note of that. And thanks for that tweet.
I was actually out in Savannah a couple of weekends ago, Valentine's Day weekend. I went for a concert, and it was the kickoff of something they call the Savannah Stopover Festival. And we had a hotel room registered, but then something went weird with the crowd. I mean, with the card, because I'm a journalist and money's tight. So basically, once we got that fixed, we came back around a couple hours later, the room had already been taken. And that weekend, there were no hotel rooms available.
No room at the inn?
Anywhere in the city of Savannah.
Not what'd you do?
I slept in the car.
Oh, Shelton.
It's okay. I didn't sleep much. We were up all night.
Man, that's a good problem for Savannah to have. Mm-hmm. You wanted to stay and you just slept in your car. That's pretty incredible.
And we have more restaurants coming downtown. The restaurants.
We're going to talk about that in a minute.
Okay.
But if you're just tuning in, it's our Friday Media Roundtable with Angela Spears, Mark Woods, Tim Gibbons, and Shelton Hall, and your calls at 549-2937 as we talk about this top news headlines of the week. Here's another one that caught our eye. The Duval County School Board this week voted to deny an application for a proposed charter school on the north side. It sparked concern from Superintendent Diana Green, who said the diversity plan for Seaside Charter would segregate students against Florida law. Now, Seaside says it's going to appeal this decision to the Florida State Board of Education, and they may sue Green personally. So what about this? The superintendent is saying that the Seaside Charter schools don't have diverse student populations. They have one at the beaches and one in the San Jose neighborhood. And they wanted to construct one on the north side in an area with a large African-American population. Her argument, this would create basically separate but equal schools. The separate but equal tenet struck down, of course, by the U.S. Supreme Court in 1954 in Brown versus Board of Education. The Seaside management is saying that that's just not a valid argument, that they're just trying to provide a quality education to different neighborhoods of town. And so this is an interesting story to look at, because as charters proliferate and try to set up shop in different neighborhoods with different demographics, we can probably see something like this happening, I would guess, again. Is Seaside in the wrong? Are they afoul of Florida law?
I don't know if they're necessarily in the wrong. Perhaps the student populations aren't as diverse as they could be, but then you have to ask how many people are trying to get into that school. If it's a case of you have, you know, a diverse range of people applying to be part of the school, and they're not, and that doesn't reflect in the student body, that's one thing. I think the idea of putting a charter school out on the north side is a fine thing.
You look at the KIPP schools, which have a mostly African-American population. They haven't been accused of this. And I'm just speculating a little bit, but is this a backdoor way to deny another charter application using this argument?
Well, I mean, there is the idea that there's a fairly strict set of requirements that charter schools have to meet. And as with any regulation, if you want to interpret them as strictly as possible, you can use that as cover for, you know, for denying somebody something because they are indeed technically not meeting what they should
not
meet.
Not meeting the strict letter of
right,
the law.
Even if that is not the actual motivating reason for denying.
And I'm curious to see, too, are school boards finding, I'm not saying that's what's happening here, but are school boards going to be finding creative ways to shut down the proliferation of charters as they sort of bureaucratically push back against the proliferation of charter schools? Is that part of what could be happening here? I don't know. But certainly there's tension between school boards and charters, not just here, but all over the country, given that charter schools do receive public funds, but they aren't always held to the same accountability standards. School boards don't like having the lack of oversight. There's always going to be tension there.
And some people would say that parents just want a choice. Everybody wants their kid to be educated, right? Every parent wants their child to have a good education and have access to that. So that debate with public school versus charter schools, some are saying it's a choice. And Melissa, going back to the other issue, I think it's sad that in this day and age, we're 2019, right? That we're still talking about inequality in schools, that's even an issue. Is sad. It happens, but it's just, to me, still sad that we're still talking about this in 2019.
Yeah, that's long been the reality,
yeah.
Though. Unfortunately. Mark Woods.
You mentioned the accountability and oversight not being the same as stringent for charter schools. So when I see that on the front end, they're going to hold to very strict standards, that makes me want to support, you know, the public schools, and because you're not going to have this after the fact. So on that side, I kind of agree with what played out. The other side, I guess, when I read, you know, I think they said you're going to have locations where the majority of students will be non-minority, and then you're going to have a location where the majority of students will be minority.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
That's true in public schools.
Exactly.
Too.
So that's right.
To say that that's a reason for denying a charter school, I don't know that I buy that. Although that's kind of the main premise of this argument.
Yeah, exactly.
I have, you know, just more in general a problem with some. I always want to say some charter schools that, you know, I don't want to lump all together, but it's the lack of oversight and accountability that you mentioned.
It's 549-2937. Susan is in Mandarin. Hi, Susan. Good morning.
Hi. So my question is this, is diversity valuable? I went to a One Jack's community supper last night, and a lot of the people that was at the supper said that we all need to learn how to be more civil. And one of the ways that it is especially important is to be civil with people that are different from us. And if we keep segregating all our schools and people just see people exactly like them, how do we, it just doesn't seem like it's a good thing for our society. I'm opposed personally to all girls' schools. I'm opposed to schools where it's only one race. I think that we should have diverse schools. And I think that Seaside is a Waldorf school, which is like a hippy-dippy kind of school, I think. And so if they are encouraged,
I want to go to one of those.
I don't know. I could be wrong about that. But if they encourage whatever diversity they're lacking, they should go to a neighborhood school and ask the principal, who is the worst student here that is from whatever race that they need to make them more diverse, and bring the bad kid into the charter school, because charters claim that they are better than the neighborhood schools. So let them take a bad kid and see if they can help them. I mean, they can't just advertise to get diversity. They have to be proactive in gaining diversity. Mm. So is diversity valuable is my question. Thank you.
Thank you, Susan. Thanks for all those points.
Well, diversity is certainly valuable, but it's a matter of how you implement the diversity. When we talk about Brown versus Board of Education, the way a lot of that has been implemented over the last 60 years has been through a lot of busing. Now, when I went to high school, I was taking the bus 45 minutes.
And that went so smoothly with no controversy at all.
Yeah.
But go ahead. Yeah.
Well, I was taking the bus to high school 45 minutes each way each day. That's over 1,000 hours spent on the bus during my 4 years of high school. And that in itself creates a competitive disadvantage. So the question is, it's not so much about diversity, but it's about how do we raise the overall standards of all the schools. We have mm-hmm. people being bussed around from neighborhood to neighborhood to these schools because the schools in their neighborhood aren't necessarily that good. And that's the real problem. You can have all the charter schools you want, but until the fundamentals of the K-12 education system are raised, elevated, we're still going to be having these problems.
Linda on the South Side, lots of calls coming in. Let's get to a few. Linda, go ahead, Linda.
Hi there. I agree with what I think it was Mark Wood said, that the school board is criticism of Seaside is really should be criticism of themselves. Nobody has reported that Seaside's two campuses right now are A-rated schools. And the four public schools that surround the Northside campus that they've applied for are overcrowded, and three of the four are failing. So Seaside's objective was to put an A-rated school as a choice school amongst failing public schools. That seems rather curious to me that was denied.
Okay, Linda, thanks for those points.
That feeds in with exactly what I was going to say, which it follows up on Shelton's comments. Of the problem with charter schools is there's a bunch of the education establishment has issues with this new entrant, and in some ways it's because of things, as Mark mentioned, a lack of oversight and a feeling that they get to cherry pick students and that they're not competing in the same way. But on the other side of that is the idea that oftentimes are looking at neighborhoods that don't have good schools. And it's really hard to push back against an institution who says, your schools are failing, we're going to come in with a better alternative. Even if you don't like charter schools, it's hard to argue against that because it helps kids. And that's the point of the education
system. One more call on this. It's Sarah in Atlantic Beach. Go ahead, Sarah.
Yes, hi. I was just going to say that my daughter attends the Seaside Charter in Atlantic Beach, and one of her best friends is a minority student there, and she's one of the very few minority students there, and she travels all the way from Jacksonville Airport area to get to the school. So it's a matter of access, I think. There's no hidden agenda at Seaside Charter. It's simply a matter of access and putting it in a location where more students would have that access, more minority students.
And what do you like about the school, Sarah?
Well, it's a Waldorf-inspired school, so it's got a very unique approach, a lot of outdoor activities, a lot of handwork, very creative, artistic, not rigid, no grades. They do have grades, but they're not in the report cards to the students. The students are encouraged to develop individually. It's a wonderful school.
Yeah, I think a previous caller said it has a hippy dippy vibe, which is funny. What I hear you saying is, I kind of think of Brown University. It's like the Ivy League that has that same sort of approach. They don't have traditional grades. You can pick your own curriculum, and you as a parent, you like that.
I love it. My daughter's really excelling there. She's exposed to lots of different things. She asked to sew my clothes the other day for fun, so she's learning different things, but at the same time, obviously, the core curriculum that she needs to for Florida, but in an atmosphere that's allowing her to really thrive. She's a first grader, and so it's just been a great school.
Thank you for that, Sarah. This topic has certainly touched a nerve. Lots of parents are calling in about this. Let's take a call from Savannah on the west side. Hi, Savannah. What are your thoughts?
Hey, so I have a child that goes to the Mandarin location, and we're all the way over here on the west side, and there's several of us parents that, you know, we've tried to carpool to get our kids over there so that they can experience, you know, that great education that they give. And I feel like that's a big part. If, you know, if anything with the issue of diversity, it's the fact that, you know, there's we over here, you know, in areas where the schools are not so great, we're trying to give our kids the opportunities. And there's no reason why the North Side shouldn't have that either. You know, if they're feeling like it's not going to be so diverse, then maybe they need to come up with transportation plans or something like that. But it's ridiculous. It is a very diverse school. There's people that have moved here from across the country just so that they could get this education.
Just to go to this school?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. It's crazy, right? I thought it was crazy when I heard it. But, you know, my daughter's been there for 2 years. And, I mean, there were people that have moved from Colorado. Because you typically, it's a Waldorf-based education. And anywhere else, it's, like, super expensive. So to have the opportunity for these kids to get this great education, I mean, it's been such a positive thing for especially my daughter. I mean, we tried Montessori, and that was great. And then moving to the west side, we tried public school, and it didn't really work.
Okay.
So she's really thrived.
And Savannah, I so appreciate this. Lots of parents wanting to give their insights about this. So adding some texture to this story, which will be an interesting one to follow.
And Melissa, it's like I said earlier, parents want a choice. And then the flip side of this, what does this say about our public schools? Do you think this maybe is a challenge to our public schools to have the school board maybe step up some things with what's going on in the public schools, maybe doing things a different way?
To be fair to the public schools, the graduation rate is up significantly. The prior superintendent and the current superintendent have increased choices on the menu, so to speak, of programs that are available. But that said, certainly lots of parents out there have a lot to say about this. So we'll continue to follow it. And so will all of my media colleagues here. Finally, we're almost out of time, but it's our look at the strange, bizarre, and just plain ridiculous from the week. Luckily, there was never a shortage of material. Here it is for you right now, only in Florida. And I should say only in Duval do you have a Florida Man baseball game. You've heard of Florida Man, right? Well, the Jumbo Shrimp are hosting a Florida Man night on July 26th when Jacksonville will break a weird Florida law in every single inning. Come on out to this game as fans will be invited to break Florida laws. We don't know which laws will be broken, but
murder.
No murder. Hopefully, is on the agenda. There is a Twitter rumor, as yet unconfirmed, that one of the laws involves no singing in bathing suits. Oh. That's on the Florida books.
If the entire stadium gets arrested, that would be the best Florida Man story ever.
This will be a fun and unique night. The Jumbo Shrimp will cap it with a post-game fireworks show. Mark your calendars for Florida Man night at the ballpark on July 26th. I hope you guys are all going to be there.
Oh, yeah.
Wow, I'm going to put that on my calendar.
All right. Thanks, Angela, Mark, Tim, and Shelton. And up next, all the action live from the Concours d'Elegance. We'll be right back.
Drive drunk, but talking on the phone creates the same risk. Learn about distracted driving presentations for the workforce.
Learn more at waynehogan.law.
Clay Today reaches the heart of Clay County. Clay Today print and digital products promotes businesses while providing local news and current happenings in Clay County. Information at claytodayonline.com.
Whether you're a homeowner or not, housing data is an important economic indicator. Understanding that data, though, is a whole nother thing.
We're always hearing about the current number, but we hardly ever hear about the revision, and of course, the revision's where the interest is.
I'm Kai Rizdahl, step by step through the housing data next time on Marketplace.
Weeknights at 6 on 89.9 WJCT.
I'm Ira Flatow. This week on Science Friday, a second patient is in long-term remission from HIV, a decade after the first such case. Can their stories point to a cure for everyone else? Plus, did you know that dinosaurs got arthritis? What bones from the past tell us about your own skeleton? It's all on Science Friday from WNYC Studios.
Friday at 3 on 89.9 WJCT.
After failed peace talks, is North Korea up to its old tricks?
I would be very, very disappointed in Chairman Kim, and I don't think I will be, but we'll see what happens. We'll take a look.
Also, Nicolas Maduro comes under the spotlight for moving money and gold out of Venezuela. And who will Canada's corruption crisis claim next? The Friday News Roundup, next time on 1A.
Today at 11 on 89.9 WJCT.
Welcome back. Well, finally, at this hour, this region's biggest automotive event takes place in Amelia Island this weekend. Roughly 20,000 people are expected to turn out for the 24th annual Amelia Island Concours d'Elegance. So much happening, and we are pleased to have live from the scene now, Dan Scanlon of the Florida Times Union. He's on the phone. He's up on Amelia Island. It's probably your favorite weekend of the year, Dan, as a noted local gearhead. So, good morning.
Good morning. I love it here. You know, police say 10 to 12,000 people alone are going to be here on Sunday for the actual Concours d'Elegance car event. 300 plus classic cars there. I mean, the Porsche 962 Endurance Racer is featured. The 50th anniversary of Gainesville Raceway is going to be featured along with a cackle fest at 12:30 p.m. Sunday. They're going to light the fires on those drag racers. There's going to be mid-engine cars, including a Wankel rotary-engined Corvette that hasn't been seen here in years. Cars and guitars with John Oates of Hall & Oates is going to be here with a co-curated display of rock stars cars and rock stars guitars. And then Jackie Ickx, six-time Le Mans winner, is going to be here, and he's driving in at 9:45 a.m. in his 1981 Le Mans winning Porsche Endurance Racer. So that's just some of what's going to happen on Sunday. And I'm surrounded by McLarens. I'm surrounded by Porsches. I'm surrounded by Mercedes AMGs, all being driven around for folks who want to go play with the new stuff while the classic cars are out on road tour right now through Duval and Nassau County.
The classic cars, I think, are the most exciting for me when I've attended. You know, these are just incredible works of art, Dan. Can you tell us a little bit more about the classic cars and what we'll see and why you think they have such enduring appeal?
Well, some of these cars are 100 or plus years old, and they show the innovations that came from Europe and America with electric starters and pneumatic tires. I know that sounds hilarious right now, but back then those were big things, and they are coach-built. They are beautiful. The classic Rolls Royces, the Packards of the 30s, which were technological tour de forces, are going to be out there. And then you obviously have the mid-engine race cars of the 60s and 70s here, including a rotary-engine Corvette. Now we're finally getting a new mid-engine Corvette coming in the next year or so, but they've been toying with that idea at General Motors for years, and we get to see one that hasn't been here in the U.S. in decades. I mean, the classic cars, that's my favorite. The older, the better. And like I said, a lot of them are out right now on a road tour. So there was a Darren Body Packard convertible. Another class, German coach-built Beetles. We all think of the Beetle as this little, you know, bug-shaped thing. No, there were German coach builders building special versions of them. Even a four-door taxi from 1953 is on the field, but it's the coach built with the stunning design lines and the two colors that look so sporty, but it's a little 36-horsepower Beetle engine in there. Huh. Just amazing cars that will be here Sunday.
Now, tell us a little bit more about what you mentioned a minute ago. John Oates of Hall & Oates fame is going to be at the big event. He has co-curated a Cars of the Rock Stars class with vehicles and guitars from his guitar collection and other guitars from other famous rock stars.
Yeah, he's here with his beautiful, what's called an Outlaw 356. That's a 1960s rear-engine Porsche. I saw him out driving it yesterday. He's bringing another one of his cars. We're going to see cars associated with or owned by rock stars out there, along with some of their cool guitars. And right now at the RM Sotheby's auction is a specially painted guitar going up for auction for charity here in Jacksonville, which has some of the cool rock and roll star cars on it, including that Porsche 356 that Janis Joplin had done way back when with a psychedelic paint job. It showed it here at Amelia a few years ago, and it's just an amazing guitar. You should see it in person as I did, But the money goes to charity through $3.5 million that the Amelia Concord Foundation has given to charities, from spina bifida to community hospice to Shop with Cops here in Nassau over the past, 24 years this thing's been going on.
That's what is really incredible. For a quarter of a century now, this has been a hallmark of the social calendar on Amelia Island. And they have really survived and thrived right through the financial crash. They kept going. And it's a big ticket. It's $125, Dan. And so I think that speaks to the American love affair with the automobile, how much people love this stuff.
But if you went to go to the Pebble Beach, which is arguably the best, this is probably the second best, you'd be paying three or four times that in admission. So to come here to Amelia Island, to see these cars in your backyard, to be able to park for $30 or $40 within walking distance, or take a shuttle bus at the airport. And then right now there's a Porsche Club of America show down the street. There's a classic car show tomorrow at the Omni. There are six auctions on island, so you can pick your choice of car you might want to come play with next year here at Amelia. Lots of things happening. They have a motor expo with people who are selling specialty cars. And then there's a Concours de Lemons down the street on Saturday morning, done by Classic Motorsports Magazine out of Ormond, showing the orphans and the odd cars. My favorite probably going to be a AMC Gremlin there.
Well, I can hear the excitement in your voice. So I know you need to jump off the phone and go enjoy yourself. So have fun. Dan Scanlon of the Florida Times Union for years has been covering automotive stuff. And
we'll have lots of all this in the Times Union.
And it's the Concours d'Elegance all weekend, the 24th annual. Dan, thanks so much. Have fun.
Sure. Bye-bye.
All right. That's our show. Thanks to all of our guests and callers. Our producer is the scintillating Heather Schatz. The serene and majestic Michelle Corum is our director. 1A is up next, so keep listening for that. And don't miss our new statewide show, The Florida Roundup, where we take calls from all over the state at noon today on the biggest stories from across the Sunshine State this week. That's The Florida Roundup at noon. I'm Melissa Ross. This is First Coast Connect. Have a great weekend, everybody. We'll be right back here again at 9 a.m. Monday morning.
Wayne Hogan of the Tara Hogan Law Firm.
I'm Wayne Hogan. A company's cell phone policy can protect your employees and your bottom line. Our distracted driving presentation for the workforce can help.
Learn more at waynehogan.law.
Support for First Coast Connect is provided by Baptist Health and the North Florida TPO.